About 78% of Americans right now are either overweight or obese. Ketogenesis is the creation of ketones. You produce ketones when you metabolize.
Dr. David Harper, cancer researcher.
The ketones are a byproduct that have many therapeutic benefits in and of themselves, but it's also a molecule that can be burned as a fuel. But people need to realize this is a natural human state. Most people have been eating high carbohydrate diets. That's what we've been recommending for decades in, you know, our policymakers, and a low fat, high carbohydrate diet, which by the way, never had any robust science behind it. So you just need to swap out the potatoes, rice, pasta, bread, and then you're adding in more. Most chronic disease is kind of self-inflicted. So when we're talking about chronic disease, we're talking about cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's. It's virtually impossible to prove scientifically. However, if you look at what we've been recommending in the West since the 1980s, since the first US dietary guidelines, which is this high carbohydrate diet, low fat diet, and you can just look at all the numbers, the increase in obesity, the increase in insulin resistance, the increase in inflammation, the increase in cardiovascular disease, increase in cancer.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. I like to talk health, well-being, and self-improvement every Monday and Thursday, where I'm joined by some of the world's leading experts from the health, wellness, and self-improvement world. So if that is your thing, well, then please do like, subscribe, because it's free and it takes 2 seconds. Share with other people who you think might get value and education from tuning in. I do leave the podcast a positive rating, as many of you have already done to date. I think we're at about 4.5, almost 5 stars out of 5, which is absolutely fantastic. And a reminder, we are now on Instagram and on YouTube if you want to check out the videos of these episodes. And Spotify are allowing podcasters like myself to put the videos of their episodes on the Spotify platform. So if you want to check out the videos there, you are free to do so. Now, today I am joined by Dr. David Harper. He is a health educator and cancer researcher and author of BioDiet. We talk about ketogenesis. We ask what it is and what the ketogenic diet actually looks like. We hear about the axis of illness and the role carbohydrates play when adopting the ketogenic way of life. Dr. Harper discusses the impact modern diets have on chronic inflammation and their contribution to metabolic disease. Expect to hear about insulin resistance and what role it plays in our becoming unwell. Explore why evolving scientific research that is performed to the highest of standards is key to achieving optimum health. We also talk about the role food companies play in influencing not only our diets for the worse, but also food policy in the Western world. Plus, we hear about Dr. Harper's latest study, where he looks at the impact a ketogenic diet had on women with breast cancer. This is a really interesting discussion. I hope you enjoy. Now, let's start by talking about ketogenesis and the ketogenic diet. Now, for people who aren't sure about what this term means or these terms mean, what exactly is ketogenesis? And then we can talk then about what the ketogenic diet looks like.
Sure. Yeah. The notion of ketogenesis is, genesis, you know, literally means creation of. So it's the creation of ketones, and you produce ketones when you metabolize fats in the body, and the ketones are a byproduct that have many therapeutic benefits in and of themselves, but it's also a molecule that can be burned as a fuel quite efficiently. And that ketogenesis occurs mostly in the liver, but also in the kidneys. The kidneys contribute as well. And it's a natural state. We're in a state of ketosis, or what we call nutritional ketosis. In the evenings while we're asleep, we produce ketones in the night. We produce ketones when we're a baby in the womb, and we continue to produce ketones and are in a state of nutritional ketosis as infants, as long as we're breastfeeding. So I think one of the things is that people need to realize this is a natural human state. And the way you sort of get there
is by restricting carbohydrate in the diet. So in terms of the dietary sense, the macronutrients, which are the proteins, lipids, and carbohydrates, you eliminate almost all of the carbohydrates, or as low as possible. And there are no essential carbohydrates, so you're not missing any nutrients. In fact, you're getting more nutrients because the things you're eating have more fat and they tend to be more nutrient dense. So the actual clinical state of nutritional ketosis is more than 0.5 millimoles per milliliter. And in our clinical studies, we like to keep the people in a range of 0.5 to 2. Some people can exceed that. And I'll just add one more thing. When many physicians hear this, they think of ketoacidosis, which is an extremely high level of ketones. It's a byproduct of untreated diabetes and the sugar metabolism. Unable to metabolize sugar, so the ketone levels get very, this is like a tenfold increase. So that is an unhealthy state. It creates a state of acidosis, which is potentially life-threatening. But that's a very different thing from nutritional ketosis, which is our normal human state.
So essentially then ketogenesis is then about the restriction, as you said, of carbohydrates.
That's how you get there, yeah.
Okay. And then how soon then, for example, if, let's say on a Monday morning, I start to restrict carbohydrates, how soon can I get to that optimum level of ketogenesis that we're talking about?
That's an excellent question, Matthew, actually. So when we're talking about carbohydrates, we're talking about, there's really, you know, three forms. There's sugars, which taste sweet. There are the polymerized forms of sugars, which are starch or glycogen. And then there's fiber in the diet too. And so the fiber doesn't really enter into the picture because it's not metabolized in the same way. So you're really restricting starch and sugars in the diet. That's what we're reducing. And when you do that, it takes a couple of weeks for most people to adapt to develop that state of nutritional ketosis, where they're producing ketones at a regular level. Because most people have been eating high carbohydrate diets. That's what we've been recommending for decades in, you know, our policymakers, and a low fat, high carbohydrate diet, which, by the way, never had any robust science behind it, but it seemed like the right thing to do at the time, which is just really lousy science. And I actually taught that too. So the first thing I do in my book is apologize for teaching the wrong stuff and not checking the primary science. So yeah, it takes a couple of weeks. And I think I have a guitar in the background, which I play terribly. But when you start playing guitar, you know, you don't have the calluses on your fingers from fretting. But over a period of weeks, you'll develop those because you're stimulating the production of protein, keratin. So the enzymes that you require to produce and metabolize ketones take a while to get going. And so for most people, it's a couple of weeks, typically. And then you'll reach that state of nutritional ketosis, and then you can maintain that as long as you'd like.
Okay, so what then are the benefits that are conferred upon healthy individuals if they ascribe to this ketogenic diet? I want to talk about healthy individuals, first of all.
Sure. Well, there's two ways we approach this. What we believe is that, you know, a ketogenic diet is a natural human diet. It's how we evolved. You know, there's no cornflakes and bagels and potatoes around, you know, as we evolved as a human species. So going back to that natural state does take some time and some effort. And what you need to do is really establish new habits. So I love the name of your show. It's just establish new habits. Most people eat kind of the same meals, you know, Fridays is whatever day and Saturdays is whatever day. So you just need to swap out the potatoes, rice, pasta, bread, that sort of thing. And then you're adding in more fat because there's only three macronutrients, fats, lipids, and then carbohydrates and proteins. And probably 25 to 35% is the maximum protein. So then you're swapping out this high carbohydrate diet and then swapping in good fats. And that includes saturated fats, by the way. There's never been any evidence to suggest that saturated fats, any good evidence. There's been lots of suggestion, but it's never been demonstrated that saturated fats relate to cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease is an inflammatory condition, which actually relates more to high sugar consumption than fats at all. I'm not sure if that answered your question exactly, but it seemed like the way to go. I think people that are interested in adopting a ketogenic diet need to understand that it's not a short-term calorie-restricted diet. It's intended to be a lifestyle change, so you need to develop these new eating habits. And when you do, if you're a healthy individual, what it will help you do is maintain that optimal health, maintain that level of good metabolic health. Maybe we want to define that. And that will help prevent chronic disease, because most chronic disease is kind of self-inflicted. So when we're talking about chronic disease, we're talking about cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, some others. And they tend to be self-inflicted due to lifestyle. And by far the most important lifestyle element, the most important lifestyle choice you make every day is what's on the end of your fork. Food has more impact on your overall health than alcohol, than drug abuse, than sedentary behavior, lack of exercise, all combined. That was a 2017 study in Lancet. So it's really important whether you are healthy now or not. And you talk about a healthy person, you know, what we want to do is keep that health span carrying on as long as possible. We're not really thinking about lifespan. It's more staying as healthy as you can, because right now with all these sexy interventions, we can take people that are quite unhealthy in middle age and keep them alive for 30 more years, but it's not very high quality of life. They're not healthy individuals. So if you look at the United States, for example, because we have good data from them, I think it's probably similar in Ireland and in Europe, but about 78% of Americans right now are either overweight or obese. So that already defines them as unhealthy metabolically if they're overweight or obese. Now, there'll be other factors that add into that, which is like blood pressure and blood lipids and blood sugar and so on. But most of the population is already unhealthy. They may not have realized the consequences of that unhealthy lifestyle, because those things tend to build up over a period of like a decade or two decades. And then you start to see these chronic diseases appear. And to me, they're all a product of the same root cause, which is poor metabolic health. And they manifest as diabetes, or they manifest as heart disease or cancer. And all of those, you know, tend to be comorbidities. So they all happen together. And you kind of feel like your body's falling apart because you're suddenly, all these things are getting out of whack. The great news about that is what we found, especially with diabetic patients, type 2 diabetes, is that even some that are taking like 100 units of insulin a day, they can reverse that poor metabolic health in as little as like 6 weeks. And it really does return your body to that natural state of health.
I really like the term health span. I spoke with an anti-aging specialist, Dr. Matt Kaberline, there a few months ago, and he spoke at length about health span. And I think it's really, it's entered the zeitgeist in recent times. I think people are appreciating exactly what health span means. We're used to hearing, as you said, the term lifespan, but health span as we live longer is actually more important than lifespan.
Sure. And I mean, there's 8 billion of us. We don't really want us all to be living longer. That's not going to be good for the planet. You want to talk about sustainability. But, you know, ideally what happens is you live a long and healthy life. You're very active and alert and with it, and you have 2 bad weeks and it's all over. That's kind of what we would hope for, is a long health span. Rather than hitting your 50s and then having this slow decline of your health and more interventions and more drugs and more, you know, assists to keep a low quality of life. So, and for most people, they can do it. I think a lot of people, as they reach middle age, which I'm at, they kind of just give up and say, that's just a part of aging. You get overweight and your blood sugar goes up, and your blood, it doesn't have to happen that way. It is happening because of years of chronic poor diet, I would argue. And you can reverse much of those effects quite rapidly if you just return to a natural human diet, a healthy diet, which we call a well-formulated ketogenic diet. That's the clinical term we use, coined by Dr. Stephen Finney. And that's, it means, well-formulated means it has all of the nutrients that you need, all of the vitamins, minerals, and all the fuel that you need. So that's a well-formulated ketogenic diet. It's also, you could call it a balanced diet.
I love that notion that we don't have to accept the status quo, that we can actually take control of our health and move it in a positive direction. We can come to the benefits of the ketogenic diet for chronically ill patients in a second, but it just occurred to me that we're talking about the ketogenic diet, which involves, as you said, extracting or removing carbohydrates from the diet and focusing that on the consumption of protein and, as you said, fats, which is crucial. This kind of sounds like, well, it certainly will to some people, it'll sound like a paleo diet or a carnivore-based diet. Can we make the distinction between a paleo diet, for example, and the ketogenic diet, or are they one and the same?
The principle of the paleo diet is to eat what the caveman ate, but it's an art. What cavemen actually ate is to be debated. But we do know that one of the most important nutrients that we need is iron, actually, as a mineral. And in the natural environment, it's really hard to get sufficient iron from plant based sources. So it's very likely that the diet of, if we look at the Homo sapiens or Homo sapiens sapiens, our species, it's been around for a few hundred thousand years. We ate a ketogenic diet up till about 10,000 years ago when we discovered agriculture and started eating grains and things. Before that, we would eat some berries and some vegetable matter and nuts and things as well, but the primary source of the fuel was animal products, and that would contain saturated fat. But it's very nutrient dense too. I teach nutrition science, and I'm always ask my students, what's the best source of like vitamins and minerals? They go, well, it's got to be like leafy greens. And I go, no, it's like liver. and if you look at in Canada here, Inuit people in the north, they ate almost entirely animal-based diets for millennia, like 10 or 20 millennia, and a very high saturated fat level, up to 90% saturated fat, and on that diet are totally healthy. They don't get chronic disease. They don't get diabetes or cardiovascular disease or cancer. It's only when they start eating the crappy food we send them from the south that's all, processed food that's high carb, high sugar stuff that they run into trouble. So it is kind of, I think it's really important to, when you're establishing these new habits, to really understand what the diet does. That's why in my book, Bio Diet, I spend the first half explaining people how nutrition works, how the diet works, how your digestive system works, and what happens when you add too much sugar, too much carbohydrate to your diet, and how that does lead to chronic disease. I talk about a triangle that I call the axis of illness, which includes obesity and inflammation and insulin resistance. And if you look up, you can just Google, how much chronic disease is due to obesity, how much is due to insulin resistance or inflammation. It'll be about 70%. That number just keeps coming up. So my back of the envelope argument is, well, if those three things are the root cause of most chronic disease, what's causing so much of this chronic disease? And it is high carbohydrate diets. They aggravate all three of those. They make people obese, they make people inflamed, and they create insulin resistance, which means the insulin molecule is not able to do what it's designed to do within the body. So you need to secrete more of it as you become resistant to it. And that creates its own problems. So the good news there is if you pull the carbohydrate out, all those things, they kind of feed on each other in a positive feedback loop if you're eating carbohydrate. But if you take it out, it goes the other way. The obesity goes down, the inflammation goes down. We can measure that through C-reactive protein or similar molecules we can measure in the blood. The insulin resistance goes down. We can measure that through a number called HOMA-IR, which is the homeostatic model assessment, they call it, and we can see that. So we've known now we've been using ketogenic diets therapeutically, specifically for insulin, or sorry, for epilepsy for over 100 years. But it's really only since the turn of the last century, last 20 years, that we've been experimenting with it and learning about all the therapeutic benefits from ketogenic diets. And we do that by taking people that have chronic disease, putting them on a well-formulated ketogenic diet, and then measuring the changes that occur after that. So I do want to be clear about a couple things. First, I'm not a physician, so I'm not a doctor. I'm a nutrition scientist. And secondly, a ketogenic diet is not a cure for cancer or anything like that. It's returning yourself to a natural human diet that must be done with physicians' oversight, because if you're taking drugs for high blood sugar or high blood pressure, you'll need to have a concomitant reduction of those as you adopt a ketogenic diet. So it is important that you consult with your physician. Now, your physician might have no idea what a ketogenic diet is. That's my chore, is to try and re-educate that whole population of health providers that don't really understand what a ketogenic diet is, and the 20 years of robust research that we have behind us to demonstrate if its efficacy. The other thing I want to mention is it's virtually impossible to prove scientifically that this diet will prevent disease. The reason for that, Matthew, is we'd have to do like a like a drug trial, like a clinical trial. And in the third step, what we'd have to do is get thousands of people and put them in two groups, one of which eat the, we call the standard American diet, the SAD diet. I'm Canadian, but we still use that term. And put others on a well-formulated ketogenic diet. Because people are really crappy at understanding what they're eating, you actually have to give them all their food. And you have to do that for decades and then measure the rates at which these chronic diseases occur. And our study was with, we ended up with 13 women. So it's a very small pilot study, 13 women over 6 months. And we did have to provide all the food for them. And that was like almost $1 million. So there just isn't enough money on the planet to do a long-term study. However, if you look at what we've been recommending in the West since the 1980s, since the first U.S. dietary guidelines, which is this high carbohydrate diet, low fat diet, and you can just look at all the numbers, the increase in obesity, the increase in insulin resistance, the increase in inflammation, the increase in cardiovascular disease, increase in cancer, and anything that's related to those three factors, have all increased dramatically since we told people to start eating that high carb, low fat diet. So we could view that as an experiment on, you know, 1 billion people in the West, tell everybody to eat a high carb, low fat diet and see what happens. So the results are here, and people get old and they get obese and they get inflamed and they get insulin resistant and then they get chronic disease and then they have a decreased health span and they probably die early. So what we can do is take people that are sick, put them on a ketogenic diet and see the reversal of the markers we use to determine those, like blood sugar levels, blood pressure levels, lipid levels, that the you know, the blood lipid levels that and liver enzymes and CRP. We can look at lean mass versus fat mass and so on. So we can, the study we did is very, very sophisticated, using all the blood measures. We also do immunohistochemistry on the blood samples, which means we're looking at how the blood cells, the white cells, are speaking to one another in terms of immune reactions, because we're looking at cancer. And we've also used, it was the first clinical use ever of a digital PET scan, which is an imaging tool that uses digital rather than analog images to look at tumor size and tumor regression in the study. So we threw everything the technology had to offer in this study that was released recently. It was in PLOS ONE last month in January, and it's the first of a few papers. So yes, I can tell you, and I can tell your listeners, that we have good, robust scientific evidence that a ketogenic diet is the best diet for optimal health for most people. Now, about 1 out of 8 people just don't respond well to a ketogenic diet. And then there's a very small percentage, which I mentioned in the first part too. There's a number of like genetic metabolic conditions that are really rare that make it hard for them to metabolize ketones. So in those cases, the diet would be contraindicated. But for 7 out of 8 people, you're probably going to be healthier, and you're probably going to be much less likely to develop a chronic disease.
Well, that's good news for a start, certainly for healthy people at the moment. Let's talk again about those patients, the ones that you were referring to in that paper you co-authored there recently. The patients with breast cancer, they were undergoing treatment for breast cancer. What were the findings of the impact of consuming that ketogenic diet as far as these patients were concerned? Did it confer upon them a boosted immune system, which would allow them then to take on and to confront the illness that they were enduring at that moment in time? Or did it actually reduce the size of tumors or whatever it was, breast cancer?
Metastatic, yeah.
Metastatic,
so,
that's it. Yeah.
So our patients were terminal, sadly. They had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and they had undergone standard of treatment and were basically, there were no more options for them. So these are very ill women and were very brave to engage in quite a significant lifestyle change to forward science. So we worked with them for 6 months. 3 months, we provided the food for them, and we weighed it to a tenth of a gram. They came and picked it up every 3 days. We'd weigh things when it came back. So some of the findings, this is the first of several papers. Some of the findings I can't speak to too much because it's the subject of somebody else's PhD thesis. It is the subject of some imaging people, and I'm not an imaging agent, but I'll tell you what we found in this paper first, and then we can sort of extrapolate from that. You know, in anything in medicine, first do no harm. So the first thing we showed was, even though these women were quite ill, there was no harm that came from the diet. So the cutting out carbohydrates and going on a ketogenic diet proves no harm. The second thing, which I think is really cool, but you have to think about it a bit, is the metabolic changes, the improvement in body weight, the reduction in body fat, the reduction in blood sugar, the increased insulin sensitivity, and so on. All of those changes, which were positive, were in the same range as you'd see for young, healthy athletes who we also work with from time to time. So you're getting the same metabolic response from women that are very ill and taking, you know, they're taking chemotherapies and so on as a standard of care. But you're seeing the same positive changes in their metabolic health as you do in young, healthy athletes. So that's probably the best thing I can say. We did get everybody into ketosis, we did reduce the blood sugar levels. We did increase insulin resistance significantly, like 30%. We reduced plasma insulin levels, which corresponds with the reduced blood sugar levels. We improved the body composition, which is the ratio of fat to lean mass. And just as an example, when you lose weight, you always lose fat mass and lean mass. And the average weight loss in this study was about 10%. So it was, you know, these are mostly obese women. So it was typically 15 to 20 pounds they were losing. And they lost 3 pounds of fat for every pound of lean mass. And that's exactly the same as we see in elite athletes that go on a ketogenic diet. That's a healthy ratio. If you look at something like, you know, Ozempic, that sort of thing, one of the problems with that is it actually reduces lean mass as much or more than the fat mass. So when you're an Ozempic and you lose weight, you're losing muscle and other things. You're not losing fat at the same rate you would on a healthy diet. So just by comparison, that was good. Now, some of the other studies we found, you mentioned the immune system, and I don't like to talk about a boosted immune system. And the reason I don't like to talk about that is, you know, MS is a boosted immune system. Arthritis is a boosted. It's when your immune system is so active, it starts attacking your own body. I like to talk about optimized. And so what we've seen, we measured about a dozen different, they're called cytokines and ketokines. They have like interleukins, interferons, colony stimulating factor. These are the chemical signals that your immune system cells use to speak to one another, to alert one another to what's going on and what they need to address. And indeed, we did see, and this is a subject of another paper, we did see positive changes in, I think we had about three or four of those dozen, which were all, could all be considered anti-cancer, positive anti-cancer changes in that, because cancer is an inflammatory disease too, so lower inflammation, but activation of the right kinds of white cells that would identify and destroy cancer cells. We did see that activity. Now, because it's such a small sample size, it's really hard to say conclusively, you know, we proved that, but we did see those changes. And then with the imaging we've done, I only have access to some of the images that belongs to the, it was quite a large team. By the way, the team is we're here in Vancouver at the British Columbia Cancer Research Center. That's where we do our research on the immunohistochemistry. The team and the patients are all at the Ohio State University with Jeff Bullock's team there. And so the imaging team is all there too. And we did see complete remission of, we call them hypermetastases of the tumor growth. So usually with breast cancer, I think all of these women had double mastectomy, double radical mastectomy. But the cancer, when it spreads, it tends to go well in the bones, but in the liver, lungs, and brain, and sometimes in that order. It's because of the nature of those organs; they kind of have blood vessels. They get smaller as they go into them, and they can trap rogue cells. So most of the women in the study, they had hypermetastases in the liver. You could see them at the start of the trial. And then after 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and up to 6 months, we could see in some of them complete remission of those tumors, and in others a regression of the tumors. But again, that's anecdotal because the sample size was so small, and we were using PET CT. So the interesting thing about that, positron emission tomography it's called, is that the imaging agent we use is actually glucose, which is blood sugar. And we put a radioactive fluorine, so it's called fluorodeoxyglucose. And the reason we can use that to image cancer is cancer cells love sugar because they can't metabolize fats and proteins. So they'll concentrate sugar like 100 to 200 times, which kind of tells you if you're on a high carbohydrate diet, then you're kind of feeding a lot of fuel that cancer cells want. And when you're on a high carbohydrate diet, your insulin levels are high. And insulin, we know, is very powerful in pulling sugar out of the blood into the, especially muscle and fat cells. But insulin is also a very powerful growth factor. So if you think of your cancer cells, they're kind of like plants in your garden. What you're doing on a high carbohydrate diet is you're providing all of the sunlight, which they use to produce macromolecules, and then all of the fertilizer, which would be the insulin, that they can stand on a high carb diet. And so, no surprise, you get rapid growth of tumors. So are the basic really, and this is way oversimplified, Matthew, but the basic principle of a ketogenic diet is you reduce the carbohydrate load, and you don't, it doesn't go to zero. You still have the proper level, but the carbohydrate is produced from non-carbohydrate sources in your liver and again in your kidneys. And that's called gluconeogenesis, literally making new glucose. And that's what, you know, dogs and cats and other carnivores do and the like. So carnivore diet, by the way, would be a ketogenic diet, unless you're eating tons of liver. Anyway, by limiting the sugar levels to moderated at its natural level, you also moderate the insulin levels. So now you're kind of tuning out the sun a little bit and you're decreasing the amount of fertilizer. And then that sort of tips things in favor of your immune system. So here's a question for you, and feel free to just say, I don't know, but how many times during your lifetime do you think you actually produce like metastatic cancer cells, like cells that would become threatening tumors?
I would think you're probably doing it all the time, to be honest.
Exactly right. Two or three times a day. So two or three times a day, and your immune system finds them and destroys them before they grow. So there's this constant arms race between your immune system and the cancer cells growing. And as we get older, our immune systems become a little bit less efficient. And then if we're pouring all this carbohydrate on it and boosting insulin levels and boosting sugar levels, you're giving an advantage to the cancer cells. And your immune system just can't keep up. So that's one of the reasons, in a very simplified way, that as we get older, we tend to see more tumor growth in older adults.
A couple of moments ago, you mentioned body composition and you also mentioned the term inflammation. Last week, I interviewed a doctor who was talking passionately about visceral fat in the body and the dangers that accumulation of visceral fat around our organs can cause, especially when it comes to sending signals, inflammatory signals around the body to other parts of the body, and that can contribute then to metabolic disease. What are your thoughts on visceral fat then, and is visceral fat also affected whenever you ascribe to this ketogenic diet?
Well, the ketogenic diet is very good at reducing visceral fat, because what you do is you turn off sugar burning and you turn on fat burning. And so you go to those stores. So just so everybody watching or listening understands, there's subcutaneous fat and there's visceral fat. So the subcutaneous fat, you know, is under your skin. It doesn't correlate with bad health outcomes. And often in women, they put on subcutaneous fat around their buttocks and so on. It's the visceral fat that's inside. So you can be, we call it SOFI. You can be skinny outside, fat inside. You can have lots of visceral fat. So it's the visceral fat is the stuff around your organs, not the stuff between your muscle wall and your skin. And that fat, half of the cells in there, so the fat cells are called adipose, and half of the cells mixed in with that adipose are macrophages. And the macrophages can kind of switch to be good or bad. And when they're in fat tissue, they tend to secrete a lot of signals that create systemic inflammation. So inflammation in the short term for wound healing is a good thing, but chronic inflammation is a bad thing. And it will aggravate cancer and cardiovascular disease, diabetes. Alzheimer's is effectively inflammation of the brain. But that is what causes cardiovascular disease, because the inflammation causes the damage to the endothelium of the blood vessels, and then you get the atherosclerotic plaques forming and so on. But that's not due to fat in your diet. That's due to inflammation, which is due to sugar in your diet.
Yep. Can we talk again then about insulin resistance? You mentioned that also a couple of moments ago. Can we define again exactly what that means? Because I don't think people fully appreciate the gravity of insulin sensitivity and insulin resistance, and then what ramifications that then has then for chronic inflammation and then for metabolic disease.
Sure. Yeah. So insulin is a very powerful hormone. It's one of the most powerful hormones we have. We secrete in very, it's actually a Canadian discovery. Insulin was discovered by Banting, Best, Collip, and McLeod in Canada, University of Toronto, in the early part of the last century. One of the great medical discoveries was insulin. And so it's used as a therapeutic for people that can't produce their own, that have type 1 diabetes, that they've lost the cells that produce the insulin. And then there's type 2 diabetes, which is 90% of it. And in those people, that is a result of insulin resistance. So you kind of, the best analogy I can think of is you might have some older relatives who are going deaf, and you visit their house, and they have the radio or the TV, it's turned up so loud, and it's loud because they're going deaf, so they can't hear it. So they can only hear if they turn the sound up more. And what that does, of course, is make them even more deaf. So then they turn the sound up more, and they get more deaf, and eventually you don't hear anymore. It's the same kind of thing with insulin. So insulin has receptors on cells throughout your body, and it has different effects on those receptors, but primarily we think of its effects on adipose tissue, fat tissue, and muscle, where it pulls sugar out of the blood. And so, the cell has a receptor for the insulin. Now, if there's too much insulin, then the cells will down-regulate those receptors. In other words, they produce fewer of, because we don't want to over-respond to the insulin. That would suck too much sugar out of the blood. Our blood sugar would drop, we'd pass out, we could die from hypoglycemia. So the cells go, okay, there's way too much insulin in the system all the time, so we'll just produce less receptors. And those receptors then have less of a response when they need to respond. So the body goes, I thought we had enough insulin in there, but the cells aren't responding properly. Let's just put more insulin in the system. So what happens is your insulin secretions go up and up and up, and your ability of your cells to respond to that go down and down and down, like that elderly person going deaf by turning the TV up too much. So that's insulin resistance, and it occurs over a period of a decade or more. So what that does when you become insulin resistant is your blood sugar starts rising. Now, from a medical perspective, once your blood sugar passes like 7 is the number we use here, then they say, okay, now you're diabetic. And, they usually do like a hemoglobin A1C or a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, something like that. And they'll say, if it's above that, you're now insulin resistant. Your body's not responding to insulin. And so they'll do things to bring that blood sugar back down. So metformin, later stages insulin. But of course, if you have a glucose tolerance issue because you've been secreting too much insulin, and now you're injecting insulin to get even more of it in your system to keep your blood sugar down, you can see that doesn't end well. And so we're not really treating the root cause of diabetes through adding more insulin to the system, because the root cause is at the metabolic level. Is there's just too much, you're eating too much sugar. And ironically, Matthew, up until like a couple of years ago, now things have changed, the recommendation for diabetics was a high carbohydrate diet. These are people that have a defined glucose intolerance, and you're feeding them, like that's what all carbohydrates are, they turn into glucose. You're feeding them so much glucose, it's literally like throwing gasoline on a fire to try and put it out. That just doesn't work well. So once you get that, the high sugar levels also cause inflammation throughout the system. They cause the creation of called advanced glycated entities, which are highly inflammatory. The sugar itself can cause microangiopathy. So, circulation to your toes and your eyes and things get worse. You can have amputations. You could go blind. All of these things are late stage diabetes. None of them, for the most part, have to happen. There's very little type 2 diabetes 100 years ago because people didn't eat that much carbohydrate. They were eating more animal-based products. They weren't eating processed food. They weren't drinking high-sugar drinks. They were eating, like, real food. So that's, if there's any take-home message, it would be, get sugar out of your diet, for starters. I would say get seed oils out because they're highly inflammatory. So, just grass-fed butter. I buy Kerrygold butter, which comes from Ireland.
It's actually true.
Beautiful, beautiful grass-fed butter. I drink, this is tea with full-fat whipping cream in it. Enjoy that stuff. And don't eat any of that processed food. So get rid of processed food. get rid of sugar and just stick to good fats like olive oil and grass-fed butter and things like that, then you're gonna have a massive positive impact on your health.
Well, I'm glad you brought up exactly what you consume, because you ascribe to this diet yourself, this ketogenic diet. So could you just give myself and the listeners and the viewers just an inkling of what your average day and your food consumption looks like, so as they can get a sense of how you feed yourself on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So I, because I've been doing this for more than a decade, I've come around, you know, I use like nut flours to make some things like muffins and, you know, coconut flour. I use soy flour. I use a lot of eggs, a lot of cream, a lot of, you know, dairy, high fat dairy. So high fat yogurt, high fat Greek yogurt that's unsweetened. I eat about a handful of berries every day. I like the fiber. I like the phytochemicals that are there. So blackberries, blueberries, strawberries. Generally, if things taste sweet, they're probably not that good for you. So people think, well, fruit's good for you, right? And I go, well, we've designed fruit to be so sweet. Like the apples we eat now are so sweet. And that sweetness is carbohydrate. And so it's a lot of carbohydrate for your system, even if it does come with some soluble fiber. So if you looked at my dinner, today we're going to have some salmon. I'll eat with the skin. You know, if I eat chicken, I eat chicken skin, that sort of thing. We eat vegetables that grow above the ground that aren't beans or grains. We don't eat root vegetables because they're high in starch. So, you know, peppers and green beans and lettuces and avocados, tomatoes. A lot of what we call vegetables are actually fruits anyway, but we call them vegetables. If it's got a seed in it, it's probably fruits. But no root vegetables. And then no pasta, rice, potatoes, beans, none of that stuff. It's very satisfying. One of the things that I like to eat about, people say, well, you're eating all that fat. You know, are you eating a lot of calories? And so it's an interesting thing to think about. You know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but a calorie is not a measurement of weight. A calorie is a measurement of heat energy. So you know, you take 1 cc of water and raise it 1 degree, that's the energy in a calorie. So we talk about, oh, you're getting all your calories. Well, if you, what makes you put on weight, if you're concerned with weight, and frankly, 90%+ of people that come to ketogenic diets, it's because it's the very effective way to lose and keep off weight, as long as you stay on it. They say, well, you know, like what you want to do is eat less mass, because it's the mass that adds to your body, the non-water mass, because water can just kind of flow through us. But so fats have twice, more than twice the density, caloric density that carbohydrates and proteins have. So if you actually want to get your 2,000 calories a day that you need and eat the least amount of mass, you'd want to eat the most dense food, which would be high fat foods, not, you know, the foods that you have to eat so much of. Like, people ask, can you be vegan on a ketogenic diet? Sure. You probably need a degree in nutrition to make sure you got nutrients and so on. You can do it. What we need to do is help people understand that whole calorie model, calories in, calories out, we're not bomb calorimeters, we're not closed systems. Just discard that. It doesn't help us, because then people start thinking, well, I can outrun my diet. If I eat a crappy diet, I'll just go for a longer run. I know you're very active. I was looking at your website and stuff. I know you're a very active athlete. I'll just run more. I'll do, you know, I'll eat chocolate cake and whatever, and then I'll go and run a 10K run or something like that. You can't outrun your fork. If you're eating a crappy diet, it's going to have bad effects on you no matter how much you exercise. Now, exercise is a fantastic thing, but it's not going to make up for a crappy diet. So we call it the carbohydrate hormone model, which is about insulin. We've been talking about insulin resistance and reducing carbohydrate. And that's the model that is just consistently producing the kinds of positive results we want to see when we do it in a clinical setting. And it's, you know, I just thank you for having a show like this and for inviting me on, because it allows me to speak directly to the public. Because as you know, in the health and fitness world, there's just so much gunk on the internet. I just want to like clear the deck and say, no, this is not, none of this is right. You need to actually listen to the science. But people don't know where to go to see the science, because so much of it is polluted by, you know, vested interests like processed food companies that pay people to do research to say, oh, Coca-Cola is a good thing to drink. Yeah, it's very healthy in a balanced diet. And it's kind of like, no, there's nothing really healthy about Coca-Cola. I mean, it won't kill you, but if you drink enough of it, it probably will.
Well, we'll come to food politics in a minute because I want to talk to you about that. But you mentioned science there, and you refer to the scientific method in the book. Talk to me about the significance of underscoring that scientific method in the context of what you just mentioned a moment ago about there being so much bad information and bad advice out there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and a lot of it is, it does go back to politics, because you'll see, oh, a report out of the, you know, the Chan School of Public Health and Harvard University. Everybody goes, oh, Harvard, you know. I went to Cambridge, so I sort of think of Harvard. That's that little backwater school in the United States. But you know, that's got a lot of cachet to it. So you automatically think if it's from Harvard, it must be right. But no, I wouldn't say so. A lot of the stuff that comes out of there is their retrospective macro analysis of prior studies. And especially during COVID, what happened was people couldn't do research during COVID. So what they do is they go, well, we have all these other studies that were done in the past, and we'll put them all together and we'll run some statistics on them and we'll see if we can find correlations between lifestyle and disease, and lifestyle being diet. Correlation is not causation. So anytime they say, oh, we found people that ate too much of this, you know, they got more of that disease, and I go, well, show me the mechanism. I've done this all over the world when I talk to physicians or scientists or whatever. Show me the mechanism by which saturated fat, which is the cleanest burning fuel you can put in your body, causes heart disease, because it's just carbon and hydrogen. That's basically as clean burning a fuel as you can get. And nobody has an answer for that, because all of the results are from these correlational studies. And they're retrospective in that I would ask you, Matthew, so in the last year, how many slices of bread would you say you ate per day, you know, or how many times would you eat an apple, or how many servings of liver would you have, you know, what's a serving size? And people are just terrible at remembering what they've eaten. I can't remember what I ate 2 days ago, you know, but they're terrible, and they're terrible at portion sizes, and they're terrible at admitting to eating way too much of foods they know aren't good for them. So all those cookies and treats, they just don't, oh yeah, I had a chocolate bar, I forgot about the chocolate bar, you know, I forgot about the four cookies I had after dinner, whatever, or the three pints of, you know, Guinness, which is good for you. So a retrospective study, it's just not science to start with. It's not good data. And then to combine that with other crappy studies that don't show causation, they just show correlation, combine them all together and do this meta-analysis of all this stuff and come up with a conclusion. To me, if you're starting with crap, combining it together and stirring it up, just it's still crap. So the only way to really do this is to actually do the kinds of studies we did, which is to have, you know, what they call randomized controlled trials. So people are randomized into one group or another, and you control all the variables you can on one side and all the variables you can on the other, and you have a control group you compare to, and then you let it run, and then you see the changes. But the changes you have to be statistically significant. So there is still some numerical value to that, which means sample sizes need to be large enough and so on. And you're obliged to then at least suggest what the mechanism would be. So just going out there and saying, oh, people that ate more of this had more diabetes. Yeah, but you need to tell me how that happens, because from a scientific perspective, we need to know the mechanism. Then we can look at potential treatment regimens and so on that would be effective. So I would say 90%+ of nutrition science is garbage and not worth your time. And really look for the best people and the best institutions that are using high-level science in controlled studies. Often... frankly, those have to be done on animals, and then we extrapolate to people, because it's, you know, making people eat food is kind of an ethical issue, or making them not eat food. So we use a lot of animal models to start with, and then we can at least determine the mechanism, and then we can see if that mechanism is active for humans, which always is a bit of a stretch. But really demonstrating the benefits or detriments of particular diets in humans is very, very challenging to do and very expensive to do.
See, this is the conundrum that somebody like myself has, because a part of my mission really is to try to present science to people and research to people in order that they can educate themselves and make informed decisions on their own health and improve themselves ultimately and acquire those positive and happy habits that are in the title of this podcast. But it's very, very difficult whenever there's so much information coming out constantly. And as you said, most of the information and most of that research, even if it comes from reputable colleges or universities around the world, like Harvard, isn't necessarily of a good quality because the study hasn't been done to a high enough standard, as you alluded to there. So how can people listening to this make better and informed decisions such that they can arrive at the correct conclusion for them that whatever their information they're consuming is right and it will benefit them from a health perspective going forward?
Well, I guess that's partly why I wrote my book, BioDiet, was to help people have a source that's scientifically valid and clinically proven. And I, you know, I have a website they can go to and send me an email and I'll answer their emails. I do that. So you kind of, in this day and age, have to go right to the source. So I actually think that it's people like you that are giving us the venue to speak directly to the public about what's true and what's not. We could do a whole other show on the politics of food because it's really interesting. And by the way, the same people are involved that were involved with the cigarette business, you know, so...
you're preempting my questions now, because I was just I was just about to ask you about that, because I interviewed Professor Marianne Nestle there a few months ago, who wrote the book Food Politics. Brilliant woman, and she's been at the forefront of fighting food companies for the last 50, 60 years, and she alluded to that fact that food companies are now replicating the strategies that the tobacco companies would have taken back in the 50s, 60s and 70s in order to push their products on people. Can we just briefly talk about food politics in that sense? Because I know it was the food companies that put it into people's minds, that sold people the message that fat was bad and that sugar was good. Can you talk to me from your perspective about that?
I don't think we have time for the long story, but the short story, I mean, I think we knew that sugar was bad for us from way before, but there's a fellow named Ansel Keys that came about in the 1960s that he was the one that demonized saturated fat and cholesterol and had this whole heart diet hypothesis. So in science, a hypothesis is the idea that you then test using hopefully randomized controlled trials to determine the truth of the matter. And Keyes himself was guilty of some of the worst transgressions of good science. The famous seven countries study he did that showed the correlation of heart disease and high-fat diets, it was actually a 21-country study. And he just threw out all the countries that didn't fit his model. So that's like the worst science. Keyes actually did... with Hagler, Mark Hagler was the guy who came up with the first dietary guidelines for the U.S. effectively. And they did a study in Minnesota where they actually looked at shut-ins. They were prisoners, and they fed them polyunsaturated fat diet and a saturated fat diet. And they looked at different, you know, over a long period of time. So it was literally a controlled trial because these people were in a prison and they were only given the food that they could eat. And interestingly, the result was there was no result. There was no they set out to show that saturated fat caused heart disease, and it was a wash. Like every other study of that sort has been a wash, because there's no relation there, because there's no mechanism by which that would happen. But they didn't publish that. It was an expensive study. They spent a lot of money on it. And finally, the government, one of the bureaucrats said, well, listen, we gave you all this money. You never published anything from this. And they didn't want to publish it because it disagreed with what they thought. And that's terrible science as well. I mean, you should abandon the model that you hold to be true in the face of new evidence to the contrary and adopt a new model, which is what I had to do in my life. So with nutrition. So they did eventually publish it in this obscure, I think it was Dutch journal, in Dutch. So that effectively almost nobody would read it. And they go, there, we published it. So so the other thing is the food industry, real estate is the most valuable asset on the planet, and then maybe oil, but in a transactional sense, on a daily basis, everybody eats and we all buy food. So I think it's something like $7 trillion a year we spend on food. And about $3 to $4 trillion of that is highly processed food. And those foods are produced by about 12 huge multinational companies, like General Foods and Nabisco and Nestle and so on and so forth. And all of the different products that you think are all these, they're all produced by, well, I shouldn't say all, but almost all of them are produced by these 12 companies. So the money involved in continuing to have people eat their food is enormous. And they don't, honestly, they don't seem to care if people, if it's making people sick or not. So I had the deputy minister, I was at a conference, the deputy minister of health in Canada, up on stage at a large conference. And I asked him, I said, as a nutrition scientist, I said, why are you allowing processed food companies to advertise poison to children? And he didn't know what to say, because they do. You know, our policymakers allow those things to be done, and they're legal products. You can sell, sugar always was the devil, but when Keyes and his friends came along, they pushed all the sugar people out. And by the way, Mark Hegler, it turns out, there's a woman at UC San Francisco that discovered he was paid the equivalent today of about $200,000 or $300,000 late on his career to not demonize sugar, but to demonize fat. And it came from the sugar lobby in the United States. So they literally paid this guy from Harvard, paid this guy to say, no, it's not sugar, it's fat. You should stop eating. And that's what we've been stuck with for 30, 40 years now. And it's making people sick, and it's killing people early. And somehow that meme is so transfixed in people's minds. You know, you think of people eating like animal meat or just, you know, carnivore diet or whatever. Oh, that all that saturated fat, you're going to have a heart attack. You know, no, actually, it's pretty darn good for you. So I'm not a carnivore myself, but I think we have done some limited studies to see if there's any adverse effects from people. And I think it was David Diamond did this down in University of South Florida. Nothing for carnivores. Like, they're not dropping dead of heart attacks like you'd expect. So, and when it kind of makes sense that, you know, that's kind of Inuit people, that's kind of what they were eating is a full animal diet, and they seem to be pretty healthy on that. So I'm not surprised that we didn't find that. But I just prefer to have more, you know, a little bit of fruit, not very much, vegetables and things in my diet. But I also like to eat, you know, here they're called chicharrones. They're basically, it's the skin of the pig with the meat in it, and then they deep fry it in lard, which is pig fat. And to me, that's health food.
Well, excuse the pun. There's certainly an awful lot of food for thought there, and I know you detail those dietary recommendations in your own book. The book again is called Bio Diet, and Dr. David Harper, can you give us your website and a way for people to find out more about the work that you do?
Sure. Well, I'm at the University of the Fraser Valley. I'm in the Department of Kinesiology. You can find me there. It's in just about 75 kilometers east of where I am in Vancouver. That's my university. I work at the BC Cancer Research Center, as I mentioned, and also in collaboration with Dr. Jeff Volek at Ohio State University. The book, Bio Diet, all one word, and the site is biodiet.org. My wife helped me write it to get the, she's a journalist like you, and help get the tone right for the general audience. So, start off at about 1,000 pages, and it's now about 200 pages. So the first half is why it all works, explaining the science. The second half is how to do it safely. So they can go to biodiet.org. You can order it through there. We actually did our audio version. My wife and I read the book ourselves. We trade back and forth. If you like audiobooks, it's available as an ebook, and it's available in hardcover anywhere. I mean, it sells all over the world. So, you know, I don't want to mention any names, but any of those online retailers will be able to provide it. I try to keep the cost down as low as possible. So in Canada, it's $20. So I don't know what that is. In Ireland, maybe, I don't know, 10 pounds, less than that. It's not, in the audiobooks, it's half that price. I think the ebook's about like £5, something like that. So it's probably about the price of a pint of Guinness. You can get all the nutritional information you need.
Well,
by the way, when we tested Guinness in the lab, it didn't seem to reduce ketosis too much. So if I do have the odd ale, because I drink mostly wine, I used to drink a lot of beer. I don't know if it's high carb, but Guinness seems to have somehow slid under the carpet there. I don't know how, but it's a magical drink. So
I'll have to approach Guinness and see if I can get some sponsorship. So for the podcast, Dr. Harper, I will pop a link to your website and to your book also in the show notes for this episode. But for the moment, thank you so much. A really interesting conversation. Appreciate your time.
Thanks very much for the opportunity, and anytime.
Well, thank you for listening or watching this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you enjoyed it or indeed any of the previous 380 plus episodes, well then show your support because it'll cost you nothing. Like, subscribe, share, and do leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.